We can't do without the three gavels. Good evening, in fact, good day, and welcome to the Commonwealth Club. My pleasure to be the moderator for today's presentation by Talmadge Boston. We were talking beforehand and decided it'd be a lot more fun to go out to lunch and get a sandwich because we had found so much to talk about, but we came in here, and I'm sure you're going to appreciate hearing all the insights Talmadge has into not only presidential history, but what presidential history teaches us. I've been given an introduction that I normally don't read, but I think it's so good it captures Talmadge that I want to read it to you. Talmadge Boston fell in love with presidential history when he was 7 years old and has been a student of it ever since. His lifelong fascination with the presidency caused Talmadge in the last 3 years to pursue his book, Cross-Examining History, A Lawyer Gets Answers from Experts About Our Presidents. The book, by the way, will be available afterwards, and Talmadge will be signing for you. The book is made up of edited transcripts of 31 onstage interviews that Talmadge conducted all over the country beginning in 2013. It includes such authors as David McCullough, John Meacham, and Douglas Brinkley, and other top White House advisors such as Henry Kissinger, James Baker, and Lyndon Johnson Robb. Onstage interviewing comes naturally for Talmadge, and I can tell you as a person who tries to do that myself, it is not easy. And Talmadge is very good at it in the sense that he brings out ideas from the guest that the guest was not always aware that they even had going on in their mind. So we have that topic for today, which doesn't have any pertinence to current events at all. We'll probably figure out some way to tie it in, but I will let Talmadge do that for you.
Well, good afternoon. Thank you, Roy, for that nice introduction, which I happened to write. And George, thanks for allowing me to be here and all the great people at the Commonwealth Club. Most of you I don't know. And like every speaker, you try to size up who's in your audience. And one thing I think is a pretty safe assumption, and that is that everybody who's in this crowd today is a serious reader. Because if that wasn't true, why in the world would you be here to hear some guy from Dallas who you've never heard of before talk about his new book on presidential history? And if you're a serious reader, I hope that sometime during the course of your experience, you've come across one book that truly changed your life. And that happened to me 18 months ago. I picked up the book called Essentialism, written by Greg McKeown, who's a Stanford-educated leadership and business consultant. And reading the book turned my life upside down and then right side up. Now, the theme of essentialism is to figure out, okay, what are my life experiences and my talents and my passions that I can put all together and visualize one big thing that I can use all I got and block out all distractions that would prevent me from achieving that goal. And essentialism, like most people who read it, made me stop and think, okay, where am I? Who am I? Okay, I was a big city commercial litigator of almost 40 years who'd been interrogating and cross-examining witnesses in the course of my legal practice. And I was also enjoying more and more opportunities to do onstage interviews with best-selling authors and public figures who would come to Dallas, where I live, and we'd put on programs for the World Affairs Council of Dallas-Fort Worth or other nonprofits who'd bring in celebrities for their fundraising events, and I'd interview them on stage, and I was enjoying that more and more. And I was also the author of three history books who was becoming more and more interested in presidential history, which, as Roy said, I'd loved since I was a child. But if you follow history over the last 30 years, you realize that there's presidential biographies, and there's everything else. It really has become a dominant force in American history. So after I finished Essentialism and started thinking about all these things and what might be my one big thing, I had a light bulb epiphany in February of 2015 and seized upon what I thought could truly be my one big thing and decided to go for it. And so what I committed to going forward was to use my trial lawyer interrogation skills and my access to leading historians who I'd done some events with and my lifelong passion for learning about presidential history and use all of those tools together to pursue a one big thing project, which was to be a force for the study, discussion, and advancement of presidential history. And I'd do this by first reading the best books about our presidents, and then I'd find a way to schedule an interview with the authors wherever I could find them. And then I'd come up with my most penetrating questions, and the interviews would be recorded, and then they'd be transcribed and ultimately put into a book. And to me, doing that ought to be valuable for people who love history, because after all, I'd be getting the juiciest nuggets of food for thought from some of our top experts and have it all there for the reader's perusal in a single book of fully loaded presidential history. And lo and behold, my one big thing has come to pass, and it has become my new book, Cross-Examining History: A Lawyer Gets Answers from the Experts About Our Presidents. Okay, experts. Who are the experts about our presidents? Well, they come in two groups. The first group, presidential biographers, those who've spent years researching and producing books with the deep insights and the long narrative arcs. And it's all supported with hundreds of footnotes that tell the best stories in the most artful way about those who have led our country. People like Ken Burns, Pulitzer Prize winners David McCulloch and John Meacham, and Scott Berg and David Marinus, Pulitzer Prize finalists like Gene Edward Smith and Jeffrey Ward and H.W. Brands, and best-selling presidential biographers like Evan Thomas and Douglas Brinkley and Harold Holzer. And that's the first group. The second group of experts are who I call presidential insiders, those who have spent countless hours working side by side with our commanders in chief, people like Henry Kissinger, National Security Advisor and Secretary of State to Presidents Nixon and Ford, James Baker, White House Chief of Staff and Secretary of the Treasury to President Reagan and Secretary of State to President Bush 41, Lyndon Johnson Robb, LBJ's daughter, and Larry Temple, LBJ's White House counsel, and John Sununu, White House Chief of Staff to President Bush 41, and Andy Card, White House Chief of Staff to President Bush 43. So those were the kinds of experts from whom I would seek answers to my Perry Mason lawyer-like questions aimed at moving history's gray areas in the direction of black and white clarity by trying to find the closest thing to the truth that we can get from our top experts today about our most significant presidents. Now, that's a good idea, but how do you execute on it? How do you line up all these interviews in a reasonably prompt span of time? And from the outset, I have to say I was optimistic. I had already done 8 of them. I had interviewed Henry Kissinger and Ken Burns on the Roosevelt and 6 others. So I already had 8. And I knew that I had a contract to do an interview with David McCulloch last November to talk about his books on John Adams and Harry Truman. And I decided early on I didn't want to do an interview with a historian about every president of the United States. I mean, my book is thick enough as it is. And besides, who wants to learn more about Millard Fillmore? So I selected what I believe to be our 20 most significant presidents and identified a leading biographer of each of them. And then I came up with a strategy for how I could schedule an onstage interview with them. And with that plan, I moved forward. And from the time of my epiphany, I did 23 interviews in a span of 10 months. And with the 8 I'd done before, there's 31 in the book. So I'll explain briefly, how did I do that on that kind of timetable? What was my strategy? Well, first of all, I got lucky. 7 experts had presidential biographies come out in 2015. And so I identified where were their book tours, and I found a way to line up an interview with them on their tours. Also, I got cooperation from 7 different colleges to put on programs in front of their students, including the King's College in New York City, who let me put on a presidential symposium where I interviewed 5 in 3 days. Also, some of the historians who I had known before February of 2015 were nice enough to introduce me to their presidential biography friends and nudge them to do interviews with me. And most of them said yes, because they were pretty excited about being part of a book with David McCulloch and Ken Burns and Henry Kissinger. And last but not least, my law firm allowed me to do 7 programs with these experts in front of our clients at business development events. So that was how I got the whole thing organized. Now, my actual process for the interview for each of them was, first of all, I devoured each book looking for the most intriguing areas. And then I crafted my questions to zoom in on that intrigue. And I never let anybody I interviewed see the questions in advance because I wanted to have a Perry Mason air of mystery about me, going for the truth. And then I conducted and recorded and had transcribed the interviews. And then I edited the transcripts. I took out all the uhs and you knows, and I chopped up all the run-on sentences and the long answers into short paragraphs, and I made it as tight a read as I could possibly make it. And then when I was finally satisfied it was as good as I could make it, I then sent it to David McCulloch or Ken Burns, the people who I'd interviewed, such that every transcript in this book has been fully blessed by the person who I interviewed. Now, you may wonder, has anyone ever done this before? Answer, no. And then you may say, well, why do it now? Well, my first support for why it's a good idea to do these interviews now comes from Pulitzer Prize winner Annette Gordon-Reed and Peter Onuf, University of History Thomas Jefferson professor, in their new best-selling biography of Jefferson that came out earlier this year called Most Blessed of the Patriarchs, who make this good point. Every generation of historians asks different questions about the material that's available to them. The second support for doing why it's a good idea to do this interview book now comes from Ken Burns in giving the Jefferson lecture at the Kennedy Center earlier this year, who said history is the set of questions we in the present ask of our past. Now, at this time in the 21st century, we are now in the present asking different questions about our presidents than those that were asked by the historians in prior generations, because now there's so much more material available to us. So many fantastic biographies have come out just in the last quarter century that are thoroughly researched and written by our top historians. And earlier generations of historians subscribed to the great man theory. They just wanted to write books about the positive side of the lives of our presidents. They didn't want to go into the facts regarding what Thomas Jefferson was doing with the slaves at Monticello, or what Andrew Jackson, how he treated the Native Americans when he booted them off their lands, or what role Abraham Lincoln played in starting the Civil War, or the extent of John F. Kennedy's sexual indiscretions. Now, today's historians are all about digging into all the facts, researching the details of all the people in the president's network, reading every letter they can find, getting these old newspapers, trying to figure out who wrote these anonymous editorials. And to me, what's happening in the modern era is a good thing. We shouldn't want to know about our presidents based on wishful thinking and half-truths. We ought to know them warts and all to get to what Ken Burns calls their emotional archaeology. Now, Samuel Johnson, the man who wrote the first great dictionary, long ago told us why we need to know our heroes completely, the good and the bad. If nothing but the bright side of our characters is shown, we would all sit down in despondency and think it's utterly impossible to imitate them in anything. Now, some of the questions that I asked of the experts in cross-examining history were the following. Since by his own admission, he wasn't brilliant, exactly what was it that made George Washington stand head and shoulders above the other founders? As one of the most principled founders on the subject of freedom of speech up through the time that the Constitution was ratified, why did President John Adams support the Sedition Act, which basically nullified free speech from 1798 to 1800? Explain the hypocrisy of Thomas Jefferson, the man who wrote the Declaration of Independence, magical words, "All men are created equal." How could that guy own hundreds of slaves throughout his life and father children with one slave in particular? Is it fair to demonize today Thomas Jefferson and Andrew Jackson using a 21st century sensibility in evaluating how they lived and thought in their environments in the 18th and 19th century? Did Abraham Lincoln violate the Constitution when acting as commander-in-chief during the Civil War? And if so, was that a forgivable or an unforgivable sin? Did Theodore Roosevelt's frenzied life choices as the man in the arena cause him to cross the thin line between genius and insanity? How could a religious man, a deeply religious man like Woodrow Wilson, be such a racist and a hate monger? How did Franklin Roosevelt defy polio and use it as a driving force for his political rise? And how does the Franklin Eleanor separate lives marriage compare with Bill and Hillary Clinton's marriage? Why has historians' appreciation for Dwight Eisenhower's presidency skyrocketed in the last 50 years? And how should we grade Eisenhower in the very understated ways he took on McCarthyism, civil rights, and Vietnam? What exactly was John F. Kennedy doing in Cuba that led to the Cuban Missile Crisis? And was Kennedy's death the greatest thing that happened to the civil rights movement, since he had absolutely no skill at getting legislation passed? If LBJ was such a grand champion of the civil rights movement, why did he vote against every civil rights bill from 1937 until 1957? And in 1957, he totally took the teeth out of the bill before it finally passed. And did LBJ's extreme focus on his civil rights strategy interfere with his having a good game plan for his Vietnam strategy? Did Richard Nixon attempt to sabotage the Paris peace talks right before the 1968 election? And in Oliver Stone's film, was Anthony Hopkins' portrayal of the craziness of Richard Nixon during Watergate accurate? What caused Ronald Reagan to be so distant from everyone except his wife Nancy? Was compromise a dirty word for Reagan? And how involved was he in the Iran-Contra scandal? Why did George H.W. Bush never write his presidential memoirs? even though he maintained a tape-recorded diary throughout his White House years. Did he know he was making a promise he couldn't keep when at the 1988 Republican convention, he told the country, "Read my lips, no new taxes"? What is it about Bill Clinton that has caused his life to be a perpetual cycle of loss and recovery? And what can we expect of him as first man if Hillary gets elected president? Was George W. Bush's goal to be a nation builder in Iraq a case of dreaming the impossible dream and tilting at a windmill? Was John Roberts sufficiently vetted for the Supreme Court by the Bush team? Okay, those are some of the questions that I wanted answers for as I traveled around the country interviewing the top biographers and White House insiders, and I got good news. I got answers to them. And if you're wondering how you can find out the answers to these questions, I got an idea where you can find them. Now, as you've heard my story this afternoon about what I did over the last 18 months in pursuing my one big thing, I hope it will make you think about what's going to be your story. I hope it makes you start thinking about, okay, what are my experiences? What are my talents? What are my passions? How can I use them together and pursue a one big thing project? And I hope you succeed in that, and I hope you go for it. And may you have as much fun doing it as I did in creating Cross-Examining History. Now, I'll promise you one thing. You will have success in pursuing your one big thing project only if you are bold. And Goethe tells us why. Boldness has genius, power, and magic in it. If you're not bold, you will not become a force of nature. And if you're not a force of nature, you will never take your one big thing project across the goal line. Now, some of you may be sitting there and say, "Well, all this sounds great, one big thing, but darn, I'm kind of scared of that. Turning my life upside down, taking off on a new direction, devoting all my energy to it. What's that like?" Well, if you're feeling fearful, I'd like to engrave these words from Kierkegaard onto your wristband. To venture causes anxiety, but not to venture is to lose one's self. So go for it. Figure out your one big thing, and maybe in a couple years, you'll be the person standing up here talking to the good folks at the Commonwealth Club. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Talmadge. Before we go to questions, I want to remind our radio audience who's listening that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club located in San Francisco, California, and we're honored today to have Talmadge Boston, who is discussing his most recent book on his interviews with selected presidential historians. So, Talmadge, I would suggest that for the next 40 minutes or so, you just answer some of those questions. They're really quite provoking and fascinating.
If I did, they wouldn't buy the book.
No, we could have a stipulation here that there's a condition. But anyway, a lot of the audience questions, actually, in many ways, is suggested in some of the points you make. Let's start at the clean slate part. How did you select the 20 or so presidents that you wanted to focus on out of the, what do we have now, 44? Well, minus,
it's actually
minus
pretty
Teddy
easy.
Roosevelt. Yeah.
It's actually pretty easy because after we get past the founders through James Madison, I didn't do James Monroe. He's not very highly rated, although he was a two-term president. Obviously, Andrew Jackson was huge. But between Andrew Jackson and Abraham Lincoln, there's basically nobody. There's Martin Van Buren, William Henry Harrison, John Tyler. James K. Polk was close, but he was a one-term president. Zachary Taylor, Millard Fillmore, Franklin Pearson, James Buchanan. None of them are rated as big-time presidents, and none of them had a second term. Of course, Lincoln is huge. And so for the big one, Lincoln, I had two different biographers. Then, of course, Andrew Johnson was a disaster. Ulysses S. Grant is really on the rise, and you're going to be hearing more about Grant in the next couple of years. Ronald White, who's one of my Lincoln biographers, has a new book on Grant coming out this fall. And Ron Chernow, of Hamilton fame, has a book on Grant coming out next year. But then between Grant and Theodore Roosevelt, there's really nobody who was significant. And then after Theodore Roosevelt, I really picked up with the 20th century. And, of course, you know, Woodrow Wilson, World War I, Calvin Coolidge, who's enjoyed a real resurgence. Reagan was fond of him, the man who probably showed more about how to manage the budget and cut the deficit than any president in our history. Now, you notice I keep using the word significant president. I'm not saying the best. This isn't a matter of ranking. So I even have an interview with a Herbert Hoover historian who's certainly not one of the best, but he was the president when the Great Depression started. And so to talk about that and his approaches to dealing with the Depression, and then, of course, Franklin Roosevelt. I had two different biographers on Franklin Roosevelt. And from then on to the present, recognizing most people are interested about the presidents of our lifetime. I didn't have one on Jimmy Carter, one-term president. I didn't have one on Gerald Ford, who didn't even have one term. But other than that, that was how I went about the process.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned Grant is on the rise. What is it that's happening to modify our impression of a cigar-smoking Civil War general?
Well, I think people are becoming aware that, as Ron Chernow said at the Bush Library a month ago, Grant did more for the advancement of African Americans than any president between Abraham Lincoln and Lyndon Johnson, and really was a fantastic source of strength and support for African Americans dealing with the Reconstruction era. And so then he was also a big advocate for the rights of Native Americans. And so we're living in a world where people, we have diversity, we care about minorities, we care about fair treatment for all, regardless of race, creed, or color. And so people are realizing, hey, Grant was really way ahead of his time. But another factor is, and I asked Gene Edward Smith, why this sudden surge for Grant? He said, for decades, in the 20th century, our leading historians were from the South. They hated Grant. He'd led the Yankees. He caused them to win the Civil War. And so they were tainted toward him for that reason. So those are the real reasons why I think we're going to see more and more of a surge of U.S. interest and appreciation for U.S. Grant.
I get the sense that at the same time his star is rising, Jefferson's may be on the descent. Do you have that feeling, or is that not correct?
Well, Jefferson is always going to be a source of endless fascination, because he was the man who wrote the Declaration of Independence, who had this vision, the founder of the University of Virginia, the most articulate, the man who brought the country out of the Sedition Act and unified, and he had all these great things, but he had all this stuff going on with the slaves at Monticello. And, of course, we're living in a world where everybody wants to seize on people's Achilles heel, and definitely slavery was Jefferson's Achilles heel, but because he is such a man of contradictions and internal conflict and greatness and weirdness, I don't think the American people are ever going to lose their enthusiasm of trying to figure out who he was. Because, I mean, he's on Mount Rushmore. He's always rated in the top five presidents. I don't think the historical community is ever going to lose their appreciation, the Louisiana Purchase during his presidency. But he's got this Achilles heel that keeps getting developed and written about and talked about, and it's certainly not something that, and in my book, you know, I go with these historians, explain this, what was he, and the answer is, I'll give you one answer. He said, look, I'm smart enough to know that we're not going to solve this slavery problem during my lifetime. And so I think I'm going to devote all of my energy to something I think I can really achieve. Well, why couldn't you at least dealt with your own people on your own farm and freed them and act, you know, at least responsibly? Maybe we can't change the whole country, but at least you can take care of business on your own home front. And he liked things the way they were at Monticello.
Yeah. But the hagiography period is over with him, for sure, I think.
Yeah.
Before we get into some of the other specifics, let's talk about how you approach an interview, because this book is so good because you get so much out of these presidential historians. So what is your preparation process, A, and what is the technique you use to get them to go beyond what they've always already said over and over and over and over in terms of their standard stump speech?
Well, as I mentioned, I devour every book. I mean, I'm underlining, I'm making notes in the margin, I'm reading every book with the idea of, where's an interview question here?
Right.
Well, where's the most intriguing area that I think people in 2016 are curious about more than perhaps anything else? So I kind of target these areas, and then I craft the questions, and usually my script for an interview goes through about 10 drafts before it's as tight as I can make it. And everybody who reads a history book, there's always things you read, and you read and you say, but what about this or what about that? And invariably, they leave something out. And so that was, you know, what I said, I'm trying to move the ball from the gray areas of history toward a little more in the direction of black and white clarity. Let's talk about these gray areas. Let me stretch you beyond your book. Maybe you weren't ready to put it in print, but in an interview, let's talk about it. And so that was really my approach. And when I talk about my one big thing, the study, the discussion, and the advancement of presidential history, that's what I mean by advancement, taking them beyond their book into future years that people will want to talk about and think about.
But personalities vary in their willingness to be stretched, particularly on the record. And do you get a sense of, I'm going to have to work a hell of a lot harder at this one because this guy just wants to.
Well, I think anybody who's ever been through this process of researching and writing a history book is so full of information that when they have the opportunity to be interviewed by somebody who really knows his stuff and who's really read the book, you'd be amazed how many interviews in this country are done by people who haven't read the book. And they say, well, why'd you choose to write on James Madison? Well, you don't have to have read the book to ask that question. So anyway, the historians who I've encountered at every step of the way, without exception, they want to talk about this stuff. This is in their DNA, and somebody who's going to open up and make them think about something different, they welcome that opportunity. They're not kind of locked in on a standard script. There's no fun in that if you're a smart person.
Yeah. No, there's no, but there's also risk for them. One of the questions.
Well, let me talk about that risk for them, because one of the ways I got these people to agree to the interviews, I said, nothing is going to go in this book, not one word, unless you've approved it. And so if you say something, or if I take you in an area that you're uncomfortable with, when I would send them the final transcript, I said, look, I want this transcript to be the best that it can be. If you thought of something after the interview that makes your answer that much better, put it in. Let's make this maximum information presented the best we can as to what goes in the final product. And so that was a way of letting them think there really wasn't any risk, because I'm not going to put something there that said, wake up the next day and say, oh, I wish I hadn't said that.
Yeah, which goes to, I think, a general problem we see in almost all communication, whether it's science or art or history, but a concern about what your peers are going to think about what you say. And I find it particularly with what I'll call academic historians who are being judged by their peers as to whether they misstated a certain fact if in 1776, as opposed to somebody, and I'll use a few names, somebody like David McCullough, who can write to a general popular audience and have bestsellers and have us appreciate history for what it teaches us, as you say, about how to think about today.
Well, every historian in my book is a top-flight scholar.
Yeah.
And they essentially have no insecurity about their area of expertise, right. Their particular president or presidents, if they've written more than one presidential biography. So none of these people are insecure. And, you know, anybody who writes a book that has 500 footnotes and has read all the letters, he knows his stuff inside and out, and they're fearless, yeah. Because they feel like they know it all.
Right.
And so they have that confidence.
Right. They've read the Federalist Papers. So they, yeah. If you've done that, you can do anything.
Yeah.
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 One of the challenges that we face today is, and maybe we can date it back to the Watergate tapes, the unwillingness of current administrations to make permanent records of their conversations, their thoughts, their diaries, and so forth. In talking to these various historians, do you get into the topic of about how future historians are going to be able to do their jobs, given our desire to delete all emails when needed?
Well, one thing at this conference of the Pulitzer Prize winners at the Bush Presidential Library in Dallas a month ago is they talk about how if you wanted to read everything there really was to know about George Washington's presidency, it's all there in 200 volumes. Okay? And that sounds like a lot, but it's really not. Whereas if you want to research Bush 43, millions and millions and millions of emails and electronic records. So what I think you're going to see more and more of, just because of this explosion of information, that biographers are going to be just taking a slice out of people's presidency. For example, H.W. Brands now is working on a book about Harry Truman and Douglas MacArthur. Hmm. Okay? You can get your arms around that. You don't have to know everything about Truman's presidency. You know, that's the... Similarly, Doug Brinkley's new book is going to be about John F. Kennedy and the race to the moon. And Evan Thomas, who now is excitedly, and we're all excited about, working on this fantastic biography of Sandra Day O'Connor. But before that came along, fairly recently, he was working on a book just about Harry Truman and Franklin Roosevelt and the atomic bomb. So this idea of cradle-to-grave biographies of the presidents in the modern era is going to be darn near impossible. I mean, H.W. Brands had a wonderful biography that came out last year of Reagan, and you know, it's cradle-to-grave, and, you know, it's thick. But I think more and more of these, you know, serious historians are going to say, man, I can't possibly get my arms around all this information. Unless you're Robert Caro,
yeah.
And you want to devote your entire life to Lyndon Johnson, which he's done. I mean, he spent 40 years and about to have either his fourth or fifth New York Times best-selling biography of Lyndon Johnson, but not many people want to devote their entire life to the study of one person. Right. I mean, Dumas was the UVA guy who basically devoted his whole life to the study of Thomas Jefferson, but those people don't come along very often.
And now Ferguson now is writing fascinating biography, Cradle to Grave, of Henry Kissinger. Not grave yet, but Cradle of Henry Kissinger. Yeah. And it's fantastic to read, but the amount of work involved in it is
incredible. And it gets back to, you don't want to feel like you're overlooking information.
Yeah, that's the problem.
I mean, you've kind of, so that you don't get in a situation where somebody says, what about that?
You skip that.
You go, oh, damn, I didn't even know about that.
I know.
No, you got to know your stuff.
Yeah. We tend to divide a president's job into what we'll call domestic policy and foreign policy. And although Article 2 defines the president's executive powers in a very shallow way, we've more or less traditionally relegated to the president pretty much autonomy over foreign affairs and very much subjugated to the Congress with regard to domestic affairs. In talking to your historians, and several questions are along these lines, did they bifurcate the performance of presidents in terms of how well they did in executing our foreign policy versus executing domestic policy?
Well, they typically, you know, will have a chapter on Vietnam or a chapter on civil rights, you know, LBJ. But really what that question is about is, as far as domestic policy goes, is about working with Congress.
Right.
Can you work with Congress? Whereas foreign policy, as you say, is pretty much a presidential prerogative. And so it's really, and that, you know, that's why Nixon was so in love with foreign policy.
Yeah.
He could do everything he wanted and didn't have to tell anybody. Of course, that's why LBJ was so strong on domestic legislation, because he'd been the master of the Senate and he'd never done anything about foreign policy. And then all of a sudden he's president and he keeps all of JFK's Dean Rusk, Robert McNamara, McGeorge Bundy, all these guys, and he assumes they know what they're doing as far as Vietnam. And they didn't. And we had the train wreck of Vietnam, thank you very much.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the nature of the split in terms of the job. But, you know, nobody can purport to write a book about somebody's presidency unless he fully covers what he did on the foreign policy and the domestic policy.
But in terms of how you evaluate a president, you know, I mean, as you say, a president's success domestically is derivative in many ways from how much Congress will cooperate. He can be successful in a foreign policy area as long as he works well with his Secretary of State and the National Security Advisors.
Well, in my chapter on Reagan, during his second term, his Secretary of the Treasury was James Baker.
Right.
And it was because of James Baker that we got the Tax Reform Act of 1986, which is the only meaningful tax reform act of the last 30 years. And so if you're going to be a successful president, either you or your top lieutenants better be good at getting over into Congress, building relationships, calling in chits the way Lyndon Johnson did and getting civil rights legislation passed. And it's an art, and it takes time, and you got to build relationships. And so you know, that's the way it works.
Another interesting question is, today we put tremendous emphasis on what types of judges presidents will appoint. We tend to focus on the Supreme Court, but of course it's important down through the appellate and district court levels as well. Has historically that always been the case, or did that kind of start with Roosevelt's court-packing efforts?
Well, Roosevelt's court-packing was obviously an abuse of power, and it was thrown out, and nobody ever thought much about it. And Supreme Court justices and federal judges were routinely approved by the Senate until Robert Bork came along. And then Robert Bork, who was A-plus brilliant scholar, Harvard Law School, former Solicitor General, but had written some things in support of certain conservative issues. And so the Teddy Kennedys and the Gregory Pecks and all the liberals and the Democrats said, we don't want this guy on the Supreme Court because he'll be there for the rest of his life and he'll have this conservative agenda based on everything he's ever written about and said. And so it really started with Bork. And then ever since then, with each succeeding Supreme Court nomination, it becomes more and more of a circus. And you know, to the point now where President Obama nominates Merrick Garland.
Yeah.
And, you know, the Republicans won't even convene a meeting until after this election. And I interviewed Doug Brinkley 3 months ago, and I said, let's flip it. Let's say right now we had a Republican president and a Democratic-controlled Congress, and there was an opening on the Supreme Court. Do you think the Democrat, and Doug he's not exactly a right-wing conservative. He's a progressive, you know, probably moderate Democrat. He said the Democrats would do exactly what the Republicans are doing. Do not demonize the Republicans. This is the world we're living in. And that's the way both parties are. And so that's the way it is. Now, is that good? No. Oh. But that's the way it is. And it all started with Bork.
But in fact, he put a verb into the...
Yeah, you've been borked.
Yeah.
If you're a judge, that's not a good thing.
You can be Googled and borked. Yep. So pursuing that, given that, I would say the outstanding characteristic of the way the Republicans are handling that is they're totally upfront about it. They're just saying, hey, forget about it. We're not even going to pick this up, as opposed to in the past there would be some obfuscation and maybe some blurring and just delays, and it would be less apparent. Does that kind of a blatant challenge from what we'll call our Article 1 Congress to our Article 2 executive change the nature of the presidency from what it is in the people that you're interviewing?
Nothing ever stays fixed, and people are always attempting to grab more and more power in the among the three branches of government. And so whatever you think you can get away with, most people who go to Washington have a certain love for power and want to stretch their power, and, you know, zero-sum game. If I get more, you got to have less. And so, that's the nature of it.
But I meant not necessarily shift in the normal dialectic of people struggle to get an edge, but shift the executive branch much more towards use of executive orders and non-enforcement of legislation.
Yeah, and that's, you know, President Bush, 43, had a lot of executive orders. President Obama has had even more executive orders. And who knows what the future in terms of there will be gridlock. There is such enhanced polarization. The capacity to cross the aisle and build relationships with people on the other side mm-hmm. is becoming truly a lost art. Mm-hmm. And people somehow think we can govern with people on both sides insulting each other all the time and refusing to even attempt to have common ground.
Right.
And I think this was a very rude awakening for President Bush, 43, from Texas, who, as governor of Texas, was smart enough to line up as his right-hand guy, the lieutenant governor, a guy named Bob Bullock, who was a big Democrat. And so Texas worked. The legislature worked together, Republicans, Democrats. Bush, 43, went to Washington and said, well, shoot, I can do it in Texas. I ought to be able to do it in D.C. Yeah. He learned the hard way. Doing it in D.C. is a totally different ballgame.
Yeah.
And it's just getting worse. I don't know what President Obama thought he was going to be able to do in terms of getting people to work together. He certainly made statements to that effect, and yet it hadn't happened. It's just gotten worse and worse.
Postpartisan was the phrase, right?
Yeah, and you know, as long as we have political leaders on both sides who think compromise is a dirty word, then expect gridlock. That's what we're going to have. Government isn't going to work, and people are going to get angrier and angrier because government doesn't work, and who knows where it's all going.
Yeah. I remind our radio audience again that you're listening to Commonwealth Club, and we're talking with Talmadge Boston, who has a wonderful book out on presidential leadership, an anthology of many interviews he's done with presidential historians. One member of the audience asked a really insightful, basic question. He says, the title of your book, of this event, is What Makes a Great President? So,
well, I told George this morning, obviously that isn't what I talked about, what makes a great president. But my book ultimately is, I think ultimately what makes a great president is who has the vision, the long-term vision, and is smart enough to come up with a strategy to execute on it. Mm-hmm. The way Lincoln did with slavery and dealing with the Civil War, the way FDR did in dealing with the Great Depression and then, of course, World War II, the way Reagan did in bringing an end to the Cold War. It really is, in terms of the greats, they are people of vision who not only can give a great speech, but have the horsepower to follow through and execute on it. That is the test of the great presidents, not who gives the best speeches. And Lyndon Johnson, obviously Vietnam was a train wreck, but in terms of his civil rights and advancing all of that on the domestic front, not in every respect, but in many respects, and unbelievably successful because he had the vision and, from his years in Congress, knew how to execute on it.
Yeah.
And that's a trait that, unfortunately, not a whole lot of presidents seem to have.
What about the element of picking people around you who will tell you that you have no clothes on, if that's the case?
Well, that's a real profile in my James Madison chapter with David Stewart, in terms of, if you're going to be a great president, you ought to be smart enough to know you can't do it by yourself. You need advisors. There's a lot of stuff you don't know, and you better surround yourself with people who do know, who you'll actually listen to. And most of all the great presidents mm-hmm. realize that.
Yeah.
I mean, Lincoln was bouncing stuff off of William Seward and
Stanton.
And Salmon Chase, yeah. and Stanton, and of course, Bush 41 had his best friend, James yeah. Baker. And anybody who knows James Baker knows he is a man of straight talk
yeah.
and doesn't sugarcoat and doesn't pull any punches. And so if all you do is surround yourself with yes men, then you can expect a train wreck. And, of course, Nixon mm-hmm. had his guys, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Charles Colson, all these guys who just kept letting him get away with it. And who the heck knows what the Bill Clinton people knew about his shenanigans, who kept letting him get away with it. And so we have these train wrecks. And having strong advisors around you who will be brutally honest is essential if you're going to be a great president. Because among other things, you're going to be smart enough to know you're not smart enough to do this job all by yourself. Nobody's that smart.
To quote Donald Rumsfeld, you don't know what you don't know.
Yep.
Yep. As we go back, let's say all of us in this room are fans of presidential biography, not just for the mere pleasure of getting to know people in the past, but understanding how they dealt with the world in which they live. Did you get a sense from your biographers of their willingness to use that analysis as a way for us to think about how we think about our current world through our governmental structures?
Well, the really good ones do. And, yeah. I decided a long time ago that most people love history for two reasons. Number one is because it shows us how much things change. And number two, because it shows us how much things stay the same. And so as you're reading about people from 100 years ago and 200 years ago and the crisis that they faced, and obviously you're reading it today, and so you're mindful of what's going on today, and so a lot of these issues, in fact, are going to resonate. Hey, that sounds like today.
Yeah.
In particular, Scott Berg in his biography of Woodrow Wilson mm-hmm. was particularly adept at making what was going on during Wilson's time and his presidency and how he interacted with others sounded a whole lot like President Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And so the great historians are obviously writing to sell books. If you want to sell books, it better be relevant, it better be timely, and you better make these people sound like something that's going to make you think about what's going on today. And so that's what the great ones do. That's what David McCulloch does and yeah. Meacham and all those guys.
There's an interesting, facetious argument that Wilson's wife, second wife, was really the first.
It's not a facetious argument. I mean, Scott Berg will say that's what happened. I mean, he had a horrible
yeah.
stroke,
yeah.
and he couldn't move, and he could barely talk. And some days he was good, and she took over. I mean, she really. Mm-hmm. He said no. She was our first woman president for all intents and purposes after yeah. his stroke.
Yeah, but today in today's world, you wouldn't get away with that.
No,
no, I mean,
no. no.
Well, of course, we have an amendment that deals with that as well.
Yeah, yeah. That if somebody's...
Technical difference, but...
yeah.
So, if we were to turn a student loose, this is kind of where I'd like to go towards the end, of young people who are trying to understand the world they live in, would a pathway to that be through reading presidential biographies as a way of understanding our path?
I can't think of a better way, because that's going to explain how did we get here. Well, how we got here, by and large, had to do with what did our federal government decide to do, and that, in large part, is what did our president decide to do.
Yeah.
And you know, what did we try that failed? What did we try that worked? I mean, so I can't imagine a better way to understand how do we get in this bind we're in today than, you know, you look at this 2016 election. How did we get in this situation with these two candidates who have both over a 50% negative approval rating? That's never happened before. How do we get these people?
Over 60%.
Over 60%. Well,
Why don't you elaborate on that?
They are deeply flawed.
That.
There's good reasons to give them a negative approval rating on both sides. But
let me go there, because about half the questions in here are on that topic, and I decided that I would spare you the obvious thing. But we have about 9 minutes left. Let's not do a psychological analysis of each of the candidates. But how do we go in a country of 320 million people to end up picking two candidates who one got about 9% of the vote and one got about 11% of the vote, I mean, in terms of the population in the United States. But we have somehow structured a process in which I would say is not very participatory, and you end up, as a citizen, you and I and everybody here has the choice of voting for one of these two. Well, you can vote independent, but basically voting for one of these two people. Is there something fundamentally flawed in the way we've structured the process?
Well, I think as we look at 2016, something's flawed.
Yeah.
For us to end up where we are with these two candidates. And, I mean, historically it worked. You know, the primary, you know, we had people who ran, and they were people of high integrity and vision, and you know, even if they won, you didn't think it was the end of the world, or you had confidence at least in their integrity, and we end up with who we got this year, and so, you know, the process is broken, but can we get a Congress to work together to come up with a new system? Right. Well, Congress is broken.
Yeah.
So when you look at these horribly flawed candidates and you say, how did we get here? Well, we got here because there are a lot of people in this country who are angry. You read about Trump supporter, a lot of them are down and out white people who didn't go to college, who just keep going lower and lower and lower. There's a fantastic new book out called Hillbilly Elegy, written by a guy named J.D. Vance, who's over here in Silicon Valley, which I commend to you, about, you know, the people of Appalachia and the people in Ohio, and, you know, the steel mills closed down and the big companies closed down, and there was a brain drain and everybody left town, but the people who are left are, you know, destitute, they have horrible diets, they have horrible work ethics, and they somehow want somebody who's at least going to be empathetic and feel their pain and maybe attempt to do something about it. And by golly, a lot of them have decided that guy is Donald Trump. Rightly or wrongly, that's what they've decided. And then there's a lot of people who, on the other side, come up with reasons for supporting Hillary Clinton, despite her career of dishonesty that we've, you know, seen in recent times, with, in particular, the emails in the Comey report that showed that she had a long stream of making totally false statement about what she did. And yet, a lot of people say, doesn't matter. That's who I want to be president. So we got two bad choices. We have reasons, maybe not good reasons, but strong reasons, angry reasons for why people are aligning with the candidates. Yeah. But the polls are showing there's 20%, at least 20% of the people who are so disgusted by both of the candidates, it's all about figuring out who's the lesser of two evils. And that's hard. That's a complicated process. And you got to figure out a metric for who's the lesser of two evils here. And that's the process that people face.
Well, then you add in the original electoral process that your friend James Madison thought was a good idea to avoid direct popular vote, because of the word democracy was kind of not a great word back in 1787. So we combine, I will stipulate based on the poll numbers, that we combine two generally unpopular candidates with the way, the anomalous way the Electoral College system works.
Yeah.
And so
all I know is America will survive this 2016 election.
Right.
But I think everybody is going to agree that this is one lousy product process. If this is what it's going to bring us in 2016, and hopefully people, smart people of vision, will come up with ways to come up with a better process so that we don't duplicate it and we don't find ourselves in exactly the same position 4 years from now with candidates who blow our minds.
Well, that's one of the best reasons to read your book, is to understand the history of our presidency and understand why it worked, why maybe it isn't working as well, and what we as citizens can do about it. So with that little aphorism, I'm going to thank you, Talmadge, very much, and we appreciate your... I have to do the three gavels. Thank you.